This podcast was recorded on the lands of the Boon Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation, the land on which we're lucky enough to raise our sons and daughters. Always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
This episode is brought to you by Our Pilates, physio-led on-demand Pilates classes designed for new mums of all fitness levels and at any stage of their postpartum journey. I particularly love the 8-week postnatal program. It's designed and instructed by Han, who's not only a physiotherapist, she's also a mother of two with 15 years of experience. This program is the perfect way to build up some strength in a way that is safe. It's done from home. It doesn't take up too much time, which we know is hard to come by in the early days of motherhood. And guess what? They're giving Ready or Not listeners an entire free month of classes. To redeem your complimentary month of Our Pilates and access a huge library of classes, simply head to their website in our show notes, that's ourpilates.com.au, and enter the code ReadyOrNot, all one word, when creating an account and select the monthly membership option. Rebuild strength and confidence from the comfort of your home during nap times whenever you get a moment to yourself, and enjoy the feeling of rebuilding some strength with Our Pilates. Renee White is the first to admit that she had zero awareness when it came to what to expect in motherhood. In fact, on reflection, she wasn't prepared for it at all. And so her journey would take many plot twists. She went from biochemist to attorney to creating Australia's first doula village. She went from expecting to have more than one baby to eventually making the decision to be one and done. It wasn't an easy call to make, especially when her first motherhood rodeo left her feeling anxious, as though she'd messed up and desperately wishing she could have a redo. The trouble is, much to our dismay, while you may have babysat, may have been an auntie, we don't really get a test drive before taking on the biggest role of our lives, and that redo would never come. So instead of pouring the love and the lessons she'd learned into a new child, she combined her love of support and science and put it into caring for other postpartum families instead. Here, we talk about how postpartum anxiety still today doesn't get enough airtime, how we go about forgiving ourselves for finding periods of parenting challenging, and how being an academic who worked in the field of science collided with the polar opposite experience of motherhood. I'm Lucinda, this is Ready or Not, and here is the clever and candid Renee White. Renee, your postpartum journey, you told me, led you to be one and done, which I'm imagining feels like a pretty weighted decision to finally have an answer to, because everyone always asks when the next baby is coming. Mm-hmm. I'm interested to know, to begin with, when was the moment that you were confident in your decision and you thought, no, I really am one and done?
Great question. It was an evolution, I think. I don't think it was a single moment, and it was definitely something that led to my life, what it is right now. It led to me leaving my job as an attorney. It led me to starting Fill Your Cup and what it is now. But I think I grew up as, you know, a sister of two. I thought I was always going to have more than one child. That was like my aim in life. You know, yeah, I'm going to have like, you know, two kids and it's going to be amazing. But I have a core memory of sitting in my kind of feeding chair with my daughter, and my sister actually ironically was in front of me. She was hanging out with me that day because my husband was away for work. And I just remember bawling my eyes out while I'm trying to feed this baby. And I probably would have been about 6, 7, 8 weeks postpartum. And I remember looking at her going, why would anyone ever want to have a second child? I was like that far in the trenches. And I think for me, that was like a defining moment of like, is this actually what I really want to do? Like, do I really want to do this again? Because I suffered poorly during those early kind of days. And I guess it evolved from there. I was not diagnosed formally with postnatal anxiety, but in hindsight, we can definitely tick that box.
Yes.
And for myself and my husband, you know, we were kind of 3 years down the track, you know, and 2020 hit. And we had a 3.5-year-old, and obviously we know that the world went to the toilet during that year. And we were in Melbourne, and my husband was running our business, and I was working as an attorney. And again, another kind of core memory for me was I had our toddler in our makeshift office bedroom behind me on an iPad. And I remember, like, I'm still in meetings, still trying to hammer this work out. And she's like, mom, I'm hungry. And I'm thinking, Jesus, I'm like snack bitch, like as well as attorney here. And I was like, okay, yep, in a second. Like, I'm thinking, didn't I just get you a snack? What, like, and you lose track of time. Everyone lost track of time during COVID lockdowns. And I remember glancing at the clock going, oh my God, it's 5:30. How am I still on a call? Still got a million things to do. I've got a 3.5-year-old who I've literally dumped with a iPad. What is my life like right now? Yeah. You know, like I was just like, what is this? This is not healthy for anyone. And I think, again, that was kind of another defining moment of like, is this really what we want to do? Like, do we want to have another baby?
Yeah.
And my husband and I had really robust conversations about it because I was still in that like, yeah, I think we should do it camp. Like, let's just give it a go. And he was a hard no.
Yeah.
A very hard no.
So this is fascinating because those junctures are very different stages of mothering. We're talking about being really early in postpartum and then nearly 4 years later, which I guess doesn't surprise me given the culture of, well, you don't just have one baby, you go on to have more. That's what's normal. So I can imagine that pressure and that question would have been there for a very long time. We will get back to that. But now I'm interested in hearing about this career pre-children. You leave school, what happens next and how does that grow? How does that career grow up until you do eventually meet your daughter?
Yeah, so I leave school and I've always been quite academic. I've always been quite curious. I didn't really have a clue about what I wanted to do, but I knew it was something to do with science because I just love science. So I just went off and did a science degree and I feel like my life has been just a culmination of landing in the right spot at the right time, thinking I knew what I was going to do here, but then just this complete divergent pathway in the end because I've just stumbled upon something. So during my science degree, I kind of had to pick up a course. I was like, oh, I don't have enough subjects. What am I going to do? Thought I really loved genetics, picked up something called biochemistry. And I thought, oh, look, you know, just to fill the schedule. Turned up to my first lecture, absolutely loved it. And then was like, stuff genetics, I'm going to become a biochemist.
Just quickly on that, I need to know as someone, you're basically speaking a foreign language to me. I'm like a humanities, English, philosophy, history girly. You go to a class in biochemistry. What's class one look like? Tell us just a little bit about what you were studying and what made you fall in love with it.
So class one for biochemistry was, and for all those playing at home, biochemistry is essentially understanding all the biochemical processes that go on inside of our bodies. So it's everything from DNA replication to cells, how the proteins interact, how drugs interact with different proteins in disease states. And so I turned up to my first lecture and the lecturer was Professor Robert Pike. And the reason I know that is because he then later became my honours and PhD supervisor. And he showed this amazing movie of a protein in our body. And he called it a molecular mousetrap. And it was this fascinating movie of this protein just hanging out in our blood. And it needed to inhibit another protein to make sure that this one over here didn't become overactive. And it showed like this awesome video of it grabbing hold of it and smashing it down and breaking the molecule. And I'm a visual learner. Yeah. And I literally was just like jaw wide open. Oh my God, what is this? This is the best thing ever. And it really trumped genetics, which was us hanging around looking at little flies under the microscope and counting like, you know, different genetic traits. So I was like, park the genetics. I'm over here with like the molecular mouse.
Give me the mouses or the mice, I should say. I just called myself an English girl and now I'm saying mouses.
Yeah, so that's kind of what got me hook, line, and sinker with biochemistry. And so, yeah, as I said, I just followed that path and I did honours. I never wanted to do a PhD though because you have to write a thesis and I really didn't like writing. So I was like, oh, I'm just going to be a lab girl. Like, I don't want to do that. And then I ended up getting the top of my class and my supervisor was like, yeah, you really need to do a PhD. Like it's kind of
get writing, girl. You're going to do it.
Like if that's all you're scared of, like there's lots of support. So I did that, got my PhD, stayed.
How many years into studying? Sorry, I'm interrupting you, but it's because I'm so fascinated. How many years of studying are we at this point?
So it's 3 years for the science degree, 1 year for honours. It was 3.5. Probably by the time I handed in my thesis and got it back, it was 4 years. So that's 8 years. And then I stayed in medical research for another 4 years as a postdoctoral researcher. So I was working at Monash University in the immunology kind of based labs. And then I moved over to the Burnet Institute, which is next to the Alfred Hospital. And that was an amazing experience because they were looking at translational research. So that is essentially like, okay, great. You're working the lab with all these test tubes, but let's put it into like real life scenarios. And I had the opportunity to work with some amazing virologists and we were working on HIV. So we were in like PC4 facilities, decked out like Dustin Hoffman from Outbreak. And it was amazing because we were working with a drug company to look at how patients were becoming resistant to drugs. And it was an awesome project. It was so, so good. But as much as I loved science, there comes a point where you go, okay, I've got to put my big girl pants on. And by this stage, I had just got married. We were thinking about starting a family. What does that look like? We were wanting to buy a house. And it just is the way it is here in Australia that scientists are typically on 12-month contracts. Like that's just how it is, like at best. You know, I had friends on 3-month contracts and they were just kind of rolled over and what have you.
Is that because of funding? Is that because funding is the way that basically you're employed?
Yep, okay. Exactly. So
it's like the uncertainty of not knowing where the next funding's coming from.
100%. Yeah. And it's a terrible system, but that's just how the cookie crumbles, right? And so unfortunately the bank was like, yeah, about that 12-month contract and that mortgage that you really want, that doesn't really sit well with us. So I started to think about, okay, well, I've just invested like a ton of time in this education. What can I do to kind of repurpose that into a job that I'm going to love? And I recall seeing someone come to like a careers seminar that they had at the university and they were a patent attorney. So for all those who don't know, a patent attorney is essentially a attorney or lawyer, someone, you know, in kind of the legal sphere that say you're a scientist and you go to them, hey, we just discovered the cure for cancer, right? And they would essentially craft that into a legal document about how that drug works or that treatment or whatever it looks like. And they create a document for you. So you essentially have a monopoly over that discovery for 20 years.
Wow.
And I thought to myself at the time, because I was a hardcore scientist when I was like watching this career seminar, I was like, what a sellout. What a sellout. I can't believe this person would do that. Who wouldn't want to be a scientist? And then fast forward again, this is this classic, like I thought I wanted to do X and then I ended up with Y. So yes, I kind of was like, okay, intellectual property, that's my thing. I want to go and do that. I can still utilize all of my science degree and more. And I also liked the business side of it as well. I was running a business with my husband at the time. And so, you know, it just kind of played to all of my strengths. So I did that for 8 years, which was amazing. But during that time, I became a mother. And before I became a mother, I can tell you that I was on a really clear career path. Like I was like, I am climbing the ladder. I am pushing. I am working like to the bone. I'm going to make partner, like yeah. the whole lot.
You could see what was laid out in front of you almost.
Exactly. So there was a really clear, defined career path for me at the firm that I worked at. Yeah. And I wanted it, and I wanted it desperately. And then I fell pregnant and things started to change. I could already feel it in my body. Things were starting to change. And I guess after I had my daughter, like we all know, when you become a mother, like your priorities just completely.
Everything's upended.
Yep.
In beautiful and terrible ways.
Exactly. And it was frightening and it was exciting as well, but it really sent me for a six because as someone who thought that I had this really clear path and then, you know, this transformative experience happens and you, I don't know about you, but like I just really suffered with the internal changes of my self-identity.
Yeah.
And I really suffered with staying at home for maternity yeah. leave because my career had always defined me as a human being. And all of a sudden I didn't have that. And I thought, shit, who am
I? What next?
What do I bring to the table? And, you know, I wasn't bringing any money to the table for my family. And like, I started to feel really guilty about that. And also just, I still remember again, like another core memory of going, oh my God, I literally get up multiple times a night, feed my baby. And my daily like activities is feeding, sleeping, and doing stuff around the house. And like, this is it. Yeah. And I became very resentful, I think, to my husband about him being able to leave the house.
Yes.
But when I took 12 months off, I came back to my job and that's where everything changed for me. I was like, I'm not interested in making partner anymore. I made it very clear that they... You know, I was very bold. I was like, you need to make things exactly how I want them to be because I'm essentially missing out yeah. on spending time with my daughter and she is the most important thing in my life. So you better make it worth it for me.
Oh, I want to get into that. But before we do, it was quite obvious how you felt about career before your daughter came into the world. Mm-hmm. I'm interested to know as you're climbing those ranks, you can see the path out in front of you. How did you actually feel about motherhood before you met your baby?
I didn't actually take much stock of it at all. It wasn't on my radar, to be honest.
Yeah.
Even when I was pregnant, I wasn't even thinking about what does motherhood look like for me. I think I just was kind of thinking, oh, well, everyone else has done it. So why can't I? Of course I can have everything all at the same time because everyone else is. And I didn't invest any time in thinking about what postpartum looked like. I joke to clients all the time. I had two batches of spaghetti bolognese in the freezer and I was like, huh, I got this. I'm going to have wow. heaps of time at home. Like, what do people do at home? I was one of those people. Mums, what do they do at home all day? Like with their babies, they must have like so much time on their hands and stocked freezers and all that kind of classic stuff. But honestly, I had zero like kind of, you know, awareness on the radar yeah. as to what motherhood would look like for me.
And so let's get into your return to paid work at Deepa. You have 12 months off. Quite a bit goes on in that time that I guess shakes you or reckons, or you have a bit of a reckoning with your identity and all of those things that we can go through in early motherhood. How are you so bold for all the people out there that aren't to actually ask for what you want? I love that because most mums feel grateful to have their job held for them.
Yeah.
So firstly, how would you mentor someone younger than you to have that sort of approach to returning to work? And then how did it play out? You get back there, your priorities have changed. What next?
That's a really great question. I think I will preface it in saying that my husband and I had our own company together. And so I was bold because I knew I had a safety net. I was also very bold because I had made some other decisions in my life previous to that, career, you know, professional and personal, which I think instilled a confidence in me that, and my husband is very good at being a bit of a hype person for me. He's always said to me, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. If you're not happy, then we're not happy. And if you are not happy in the job that you're in, like worst case scenario, you go work at Woolies. You know, like if it's not worth it,
yeah,
to be unhappy if you're unhappy in your job. But I think for me, if I was mentoring other women, there's a few things that I would say. First of all, don't second guess yourself. Like you are important to that company. Another thing that I tell mums, and I see this time and time again, we walk back into the workplace and we're a little bit fragile and that's okay because we're like, you know, a bit foggy and like, oh God, how do I turn the computer on for God's sakes? How do I do this document or write to this person or whatever? But one of the things that we know about motherhood is that we actually level up because our brain goes through this beautiful remodeling process and we upskill in so many areas that we can actually have a transfer of skills into our workplace. So we are much better at critical thinking. We're much better with empathy. We're much better with facial recognition. So that means that, you know, someone doesn't have to necessarily say the words to you. You can read their face and know exactly what's going on.
That's interesting. Is that a part of matrescence? I did not know that.
It is because, so the evolutionary mechanism behind that is because if you think about it, our babies, they can't speak English like you and I, right? So yeah, we have to be able to, and this is why we stare at our babies so much in the beginning, because we are just processing information. We are just like computers, just check it like this, watching them going, what does that mean? What does that mean? What does that mean? Are they happy? Are they sad? Are they uncomfortable? What does that cry mean? And so we pick up on all of those cues because they can't actually speak to us. So that is like another superhero strength that we have as mums. So I would start thinking about what are the skills that you have acquired as a mother during that time that you've taken for maternity leave and capitalizing on those and like really just hyping yourself up about that. And also be bold. Like you deserve to actually step into those roles. You've done it before, you can do it again. But again, I will say, and I've seen this time and time again, hello, me personally, I see so many women change careers, like full 180s on what they want to do because their priorities change, their time changes, and also they're like, actually, I need something maybe a bit more feminine than maybe what they've been working towards.
It's interesting. I think as well, even though you don't have much time, as we just discussed in early motherhood, I have found that friends have found creativity that they didn't even know existed. And I think there's something in maybe like the power of motherhood and realizing how powerful you are, even if you feel weak at moments, to then go, hey, I've always told myself I'm bad at XYZ, but am I actually? Have you found that? Because now you work really closely with people going through the postpartum period. I'm really interested to know what you found of others' experiences in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely. And on the point of like that creativity, there's an amazing researcher, her name's Dr. Marianne Piper, and she did a PhD on essentially, she calls it spiraling up. So you've experienced perhaps a traumatic event, and I'm not talking like it can, I don't want to say that all motherhood is trauma because it's not, but it is a huge life event. Okay. So we can't dismiss that. But she talks about being able to work through traumatic events with creativity. And what does that look like? It can be something as simple as painting. It could be something as simple as journaling, but it could be something like a huge career change. And we do see this. The families that I work with time and time again, like I'll get text messages from mums who I've supported like 3 years ago. And they're like, hey, you know how like we were talking about the fact that I'm not sure if I want to go back to work? Well, actually, I quit my job. I started X. It's amazing. I love it. It really has just kind of centered to me and like played into all of my strengths now. Yeah. It is not uncommon. And I think in the beginning, like it's a bit scary because it's another unknown. And essentially, like if you're birthing your own business, it's another baby that you need to birth.
But and you've got less time likely as
oh,
well.
Oh, yeah. I love how people are like, oh, I can't wait to be my own boss. And I'm like, it's not all it's cut out to be, but not yeah, boss, go for it, babe. Go for it.
Go for it, but also don't.
Yeah.
I'm really interested to know what the conversations you have with mums and parents during that matrescence period or parental leave period. What are their feelings towards returning to work, even if they do like their job and like their career? What do you find that they're feeling in the lead up?
It honestly depends on the person. There are some people who are just chomping at the bit, ready to go back to work. I still remember a friend saying to me when I was dropping my daughter off for the first time at childcare, she said, you're going to be one of two mums. You're either going to be leaving tire marks in the car park, or you're going to be walking out with like just tears in your eyes. I was definitely the tear person. But in relation to the people that we work with, it is a mixed bag, but there's definitely things that we can do to kind of soften the blow. I always view returning to work as very similar to leaving work. It's something where I would say, make sure that you have a conversation with your boss before you go. Write a list of the things that, like your projects and stuff that you absolutely nailed and that you loved doing and that you're really excited about to return to. And then I guess it's about managing expectations about what does that look like for you. You know, what are the hours that you want to set? Do you need extra support? So we offer this as part of our doula services, very similar to like, you know, you're pregnant, let's do some postpartum planning to gear you up for postpartum. But also it's essentially a bookend. We could do the exact same thing and offer the exact same services around meal prepping for you, helping you tidy up around the house. All of that stuff can occur at the same time when you're returning to work, because how difficult is it to juggle all of that all at the same time? My other recommendation is take it slow. If you have a workplace where they are on board with, you know, maternity leave and things like that, if your end goal is 4 days a week, then start at 1 or 2 days a week for the first month. And it's not just you, but it's also your child, children, and your partner who's adjusting to it as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's not just you. There's adjustments happening, physical, emotional. When I say physical, like likelihood of sickness.
Yes.
And then there's the emotional and the attachment and all of that. So there is a lot to it. This feels like a good time to get back to your plot twist in career. So you return to work, you're about a year postpartum. Talk us through the timeline of heading back, priorities change to getting to launch Fill Your Cup.
So, yeah, I went back. And so that would have been, what's that, middle of 2018. So I had a good 18 months there before the world lost the plot. And as I said, you know, there was just obviously that adjustment phase of coming back into the workplace. And I was working 4 days a week at the time with reduced hours because, you know, childcare pickups and the things like that. I was default parent, and that's fine. That's another conversation to have with partners.
Did you go back at 4 days from week one?
No,
or did you scale it? You knew back then to build it up slowly.
Yeah. I mean, I had a great The reason why I picked the firm I did in the beginning was because it was female run, and specifically my team as well, and they were mothers. And so conversations were had around, like, I wanted to come back, you know, 3-4 days a week from the get-go. And they were like, actually, no, we're going to put the gas like off for you, and you're going to do 2 days. And if you want to do reduced hours, that's great. And oh my God, thank God I did, because it was like a roller coaster. So obviously there was an adjustment period when I first came back, but soon thereafter I was kind of like, look, you know, I'm really missing my kid and I want to be with her. So you need to start giving me the work that I want. And yeah, I was a bit bold about it. I'm not resentful of that at all, because it all kind of worked out. But I think, yeah, 2020 rolled around, I still kind of had in the back of my mind, are we going to have another baby? We're going to have another baby. And then obviously COVID lockdowns hit. My husband and I had the classic conversation that everyone did in Melbourne. Are we going to get a divorce? Are we going to have a COVID baby? Or are we going to learn how to make sourdough bread? We did none of that. As I said, we robustly discussed having a second child to the point where I was very adamant that I wanted to have a second child. Yeah. And he was a hard no. And we actually had a few therapy sessions around it with my psychologist and kind of just hashed it out. But essentially, what it boiled down to was the fact that we didn't have support, a village around us the first time. And we kind of didn't really, if we wanted to, the second time as well. And my husband said to me, I don't think I'm going to be able to do this. Like, it was very difficult with just one. Yeah. You know, your mental health went over the cliff and, you know, gone. And I know that. Like, I was an absolute mess.
I feel like I have somewhat skipped over how you felt in the depths of your despair in that postpartum. So if you're happy to go a little bit deeper, that'd be great.
Yeah, sure. Again, I wasn't prepared for motherhood at all. Like, had no idea. I just was kind of told, oh, just lean into your motherly intuition and, you know, off you go. And I was like, okay, cool. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, awesome. Yeah. Nah, that didn't arrive at all. So I don't know. I must have missed that package.
Still in the mail.
Yeah, still in the mail. And we didn't have friends and family close by. I hadn't meal prepped. My husband was running our business. So he was amazing. But at the same time, he was running our business. So he was off overseas, like, I think it was like 3 or 4 months postpartum. So I'm calling in like my sister who didn't live around the corner. And so I'm trying to, like, you know, navigate all of this stuff. And there was a few things that really sent me spiraling. I think the number one thing for me was sleep. I joke, but I don't joke. It's the reason sleep deprivation is used in the military for, you know, torture.
Yes.
It was just awful. And we had 2 sleep consultants come to our house because I was convinced that my baby was broken. And I was convinced that I was a horrible mum because I couldn't, quote unquote, teach my baby how to sleep, which in hindsight we know is not a thing. And so I became quite neurotic about this whole feeding sleep routine, to the point where I found when we actually moved houses, I found the notebook that I would write in all the hour and minutes of, like, when the feeding and when the sleep was coming. Wow. And it got really quite obsessive.
Because, you think that had something to do with being an academic?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I say to people, you know, I kind of feel like I had, like, Russell Crowe beautiful mind moments where I was trying to, like, work out the algorithm of, like, okay, what happened this day? Because she slept, like, amazingly and la, la, la. And I tried to replicate it and it just didn't work. But what I do know is that I have an A-type personality. I have pre-existing, you know, history of anxiety. And so that puts me at a really high risk of postnatal anxiety. Stuff I didn't know about, you know, before I entered into this realm of mother care.
It's interesting, isn't it? Like, we've talked about depression. It's been touched on for years, but postnatal anxiety has really only come into the chat recently.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't get enough airplay, and I will die on the hill, you know, to talk about the statistics around it and things like that. And there just wasn't, there was no opportunity for self-care. Looking at the imprint that I had from my mother, my mum was a martyr. She put her kids first every time, didn't matter what was going on. And so that's what I did. I was like, well, to become a good mother, I need to put everyone else first, and then I'll just get, you know, the toast scraps at the end of the day.
Sacrificial mothering.
Exactly. And so that, as a compound effect, just set me up for a huge fail. And so it was inevitable that I was going to spiral out of there. Mm.
And then fill your cup. How does that start?
So I guess after those conversations with my therapist, with my husband, and we finally decide, okay, we're not going to have another baby. And I remember thinking to myself, okay, if I can't have another baby, and this, it was an arduous process. Like, it was a really, really hurtful process as well, because I thought I was definitely going to be able to have a second child. And I thought, I never want another mum to have to go through what I went through and to have to make this same decision when they want another baby, because they don't have the support, because they don't have the correct information, because they don't have friends and family close by, or they've got pre-existing mental health challenges and put them into this high risk category. I don't want anyone else to go through this. And I thought to myself, what is it that I can do to make sure that doesn't happen again? And I just kind of was researching around, and I stumbled on to doula work, and off I went. Like, I still remember having the conversation with my husband, which is, I think I want to quit my job. And he was like, okay, to do what? And I was like, I really want to just do mother care. I want to look after mums, because it makes me sad that we can't have another baby. And so I just want to make sure that no one else has to ever make that decision themselves. And he was like, okay. And again, I was really fortunate that we had the safety net of our company that we had. And so I just pulled the pin on the attorney work and set out, retrained with Julia Jones at Newborn Mothers Collective. She was amazing. And I think for me, because I had kind of already had that kind of business element as well, I had the professional services from the attorney staff, and because of my science background, I was like, I think I can put like a really new and exciting spin on doula work, because I think maybe people think doulas are very like woo-woo and crystals and moxa sticks and stuff. And some are, and that's great. That's amazing. Like, that's for some people and it's not for others. And so, yeah, I just was like, okay, I'm going to do this. And I had a very close friend who I worked with at the attorney firm. And I remember calling her during like COVID lockdowns, and I said, I've got this really amazing idea. And she was a mum also. She was kind of like 6 months ahead of me. So it was that beautiful relationship where she's like, it's coming, like, watch out for this type of thing. You know, that friend.
Yes.
And I said, I think I'm going to quit my job, and I think I'm going to become a postpartum doula, and I think I'm going to call it Fill Your Cup. And I remember, like, it was just silent on the phone. And I was like, are you there? She's like, I am. I'm just crying. And I was like, oh my God, why? She's like, Renee, this is so beautiful and this is so right for you, and I know you're going to like do amazing things. And so, yeah, at that point I was like, okay, I could do this. Like, yes, it's not crazy. I can actually do this.
I can imagine that you found so many links over the years that you've been doing this between the idea of science and, as you said, your past life, and how you weaved that into your current line of work. What have been some of those ways that you've been able to integrate or find links between the two?
Well, I think first and foremost, it comes back to my biochemistry days. So understanding how specific nutrients work best in our body, like most harmoniously, And we pride ourselves on an amazing menu that our mums get to choose from in that postpartum period. And every single meal has clear intention as to why we have paired specific ingredients together to make sure that they get the most, you know, bang for their buck in terms of the biochemistry and, you know, absorption and repletion. I mean, Dr. Oscar Serelak is well known for his, you know, discussions around postnatal depletion. And essentially that's what it's about. It's about kicking postnatal depletion to the curb because we know that food is not only important for our physical recovery, but also our mental and emotional recovery as well. So that element of Fill Your Cup is, you know, paramount for us. The other thing I think that really distinguishes us is that we offer what we call research briefs. So we were noticing that some parents had some really curly questions around parenting or like feeding or sleep or like, you know, formulations of things. And you would know, like you just don't have the mental bandwidth to deep dive into this realm.
Yes.
And, but you are desperate for the answer. You want to know because you want to make an informed decision about what you're going to do next. And so we offer that. So we have families who come to us with a question and essentially I go away, review the scientific literature, put together a 10, 15 minute video, and I essentially present the facts in answer to their question. There's no opinions, it's just facts. Whatever they do with that is completely up to them. But again, that gives me opportunity, I think, to really flex my science yes. brain muscles as well. And I think overall, it's just the evidence-based care that we provide. So everything, all the resources that we have, the way that we train our doulas, the information that we give our families is all evidence-based and it's backed by the scientific literature, which, you know, I've gone and reviewed and put together. So it's something I'm really proud of and I'm so proud of our team as well, who I've kind of handpicked along the last 4 years, and everyone is, I think, really aligned with our philosophy as well. So yeah, it's really nice to kind of doula along with a whole village of other women as well.
Yeah. So Fill Your Cup has obviously grown significantly in that time. What's making work look like for you nowadays as a mother?
That's a great question. How am I juggling it?
Yeah.
I've got a great virtual assistant for starters. She's amazing. I find communication is key for me. I find that I have to practice what I preach, which is essentially finding my village, which entails we're now in Hobart now. When I started it in Melbourne, we kind of had my parents who were helping out, but now we have my husband's parents. So they've got specific days. And I'm like, you're doing childcare pickup. You're doing school pickup. Can you have my daughter over for a sleepover? This is how I juggle, you know, everything. But I think also having days where I block things. So it's like this day will be content generation. This day will be marketing. This day will be, you know, podcasts or whatever it is. I think the human brain, particularly as mothers, we can get caught up in like jumping all over and being quite scattered. And I found for me,
always.
Yeah.
It's like that reel, that like Friends reel. I think they're like at a clothing sale or something on an episode of Friends and they're just running around because they want to beat everyone to everything. I'm like, that is me all the time.
Yes. Yeah. You just, and then like you get those moments where you're just like, oh my God, that's a really great idea. It's like, hold on a minute, stay on task, stay on task. I'm constantly saying that to myself, stay yes. on task, Renee. So yeah, I think it's about calling on your village. It's about leaning into what works for your brain, which for me is definitely having block days, I call them. But I think that and asking for help and all of those things, the best thing that comes out of that for me is opportunity for self-care, because I was that self-sacrificing mother for so many years. And now I'm like, I'm done. I'm not doing it because I know that I'm not a nice person to be around when that happens. And I'm not the best mother I can be. I'm not the best friend, the best wife, whatever. And so things like prioritizing my health. So gym is very important for me. I will regularly book in massages. I'll regularly book in. We have a monthly girls' night out with my best friends. All of those things, they don't have to be expensive. It is just what, you know, I guess works for you, but you have to put yourself first and you need to book that time in. Otherwise it won't happen at all. Yes. And it's something I'm still practicing at doing and becoming better at.
And so these conversations of going from one to two with your partner, I imagine brought up some, you could tell me I'm wrong here, but I'm imagining it brought up some tension and some really difficult times in those conversations and maybe some hurt and pain on your side and some maybe stress and anxiety on your partner's side. You can tell me. Mm. And I'm thinking this happens no matter what the jump might be for some people. Like some people ache for a fourth baby in the way that maybe you did for the second. So for anyone that's going through that, how would you advise you work through it best with your partner? Because I can imagine that being so upsetting, but then it's important to honor their feelings and their wants and needs too. So that's a really challenging thing to move through.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess it just depends on your dynamic, really. I found it extremely helpful to have like a third party involved. So obviously, you know, I had a relationship with my psychologist. I'd been seeing her on and off for 10 years. So we just kind of like, you know, pressed the play button on that and said, yep, let's just get her in to like chat about that. But I think it is, as you said, it's about listening to your partner as well. And I was very defensive. I was very angry and aggressive towards my husband because I was just like, I can't believe it. I don't understand why you don't want to have a baby. But once I actually paused and heard what he was saying, it actually had nothing to do with him and everything to do with me, which was that he was trying to protect me because he was like, I saw how difficult it was for you to have just one child. Yeah. And so when, you know, I engage that rational part of my brain, which sometimes
even the scientists forget about.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I guess when the emotional part was kind of taken out of it and we mapped it out and we were like, okay, you know, poor mental health, that wasn't great. And not no family and friends close by. We can't change that part. We can't change the fact that I have a history of, you know, anxiety. And so, you know, that's just another kind of, and the fact that it had happened with my first daughter, the likelihood would be very high for the next one. So we mapped out all of these things and we were like, okay, what can we control and what can we not control? And a lot of it we couldn't. So it was just kind of decided, okay, based on that, it's that kind of risk profiling, right? Is this a good idea? Is this not a good idea? And one of the things that my psychologist kept talking to me about was like, she just kept saying, I just don't want you to resent him.
Yeah.
After this, in this process. And that's what I mean. Like when it comes to that moment of you've decided, I will tell you it's not a single moment. Even now, like I'm 7 years postpartum and we are 4 years, you know, past that conversation, I still get like little, oh, be nice to have a second child, like moments.
Yeah.
And I want to just reiterate that's totally normal. It's totally normal. And I think, you know, it's probably something that's going to be with me for the rest of my life. Am I comfortable in only having one child? Absolutely.
Yeah.
But those moments of like the what ifs, they still creep in every so often.
I'm nervous to ask this question because I don't want to suggest anything, but I'm trying to think if this was my situation and my partner wasn't sure about the next. Did you feel like he was offending your, or do you think, did you feel like he was commenting on your skill as a mother, even though he wasn't? Is that a place where your brain went, or did it not go there?
It didn't. No, I don't think it really went there as like a main point. I might have had an inkling of it, of like, I'm deeply offended, what do you mean I can't handle this? You know what I'm curious to know? I think one of the things that did crop up in my head, though, was, and I think this is the scientist in me, I wanted a redo. And it sounds really odd. I wanted to experiment to see what would happen with all the knowledge that I then knew.
Yes.
What would happen with the second child? Would I still have postnatal anxiety? What happens if, and I didn't know about doulas at this stage, okay? So, like, we hadn't even gone into that realm yet. So I really wanted a redo because I was desperate to see what does N equals 2 equal, like, in terms of experience. So, yeah, in answer to your question, I don't think we really, like, my brain didn't go that way, but my brain definitely did go with the, I really want to experiment and see, you know what? I wanted to see if I could be a better mum.
That's so fascinating. And I obviously, I mean, I know you know this, but I'm just a sensitive person and I'm trying to think how I would react. And that's, I'd be like, what, don't you think I'm a good mum or something like that? Even though I would know it's not logical. I'm really fascinated by this idea of a redo, particularly this week. I've been thinking about how it's interesting in our careers that we can have blunders or we can go through challenging times and then you might get a new job and just totally forget about a challenging past job. Mm-hmm. I've been thinking so much lately about how it's so unfair that you don't get a trial run of motherhood in the way that you can. Like, one job can feel like a different lifetime, whereas that baby turns into an older person, but it's still the one project, for lack of a better word.
Yes.
Do you ever get that sense of, well, obviously you're thinking about it with the redo type of thing. How do we forgive ourselves, I guess, for challenging phases or seasons of parenting?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And I think this is one of the areas that I have, I think, got a lot of peace and acceptance within myself about, because I always thought, oh my God, I've damaged my child, because I was told like bogus stuff, like sleep is as important as food for your baby. And if you don't, you know, get proper sleep for them, then they're going to be delayed developmentally and all of this kind of rubbish, right? And so for a whole span of like, let's say 2 years, the narrative in my head was, I have messed this up. I've messed up this project. There's no going back and I want to redo, okay? But what I have discovered being in this beautiful mothercare kind of sphere is that, and I should have known this because I've done this myself, is that ultimately we are human beings. We are, our babies are, and we are adaptable. Yeah. And we can fix the circuitry in our brains that, quote unquote, were broken because we didn't get enough sleep as infants or what have you. But we are so adaptable and we can have another shot in this lifetime. It's possible. Yes. We can do it. And it just relies on us giving ourselves a little bit of grace, a little bit of knowledge. And I think also surrounding ourselves with the people that align with those particular values as well, because if you surround yourself with people who consistently tell you're doing the wrong thing, and I will say that the reason why I spiraled with the whole sleep thing was because someone in my mother's group, I had mentioned, oh, you know, my daughter's sleeping like 40, 45 minutes at a time, you know, and it wasn't a big deal, but she said, oh my God, you need to stop that. And I was like, what do you mean? And she's like, you need to stop that. You need to teach them how to sleep. They don't know how to link the sleep cycles. So what you really need to do is you need to get on top of that straight away, because if you don't, it's going to like spiral into like poor sleeping behavior. And I remember just going, oh my God, what have I done? How
and
did
then
I
And you're
not
almost
know
scared
this?
About what else you don't know, because you think,
exactly.
How did I get so wrong? What else am I doing wrong?
Yes. So here I am, just kind of like flying by the seat of my pants in, you know, early motherhood days, and then just getting the fear of God put into me about this. But as I said, in hindsight, We're so adaptable. We're human beings. We can totally do this. It just requires a bit of grace, a bit of knowledge, and surrounding yourself with people who are totally aligned with you as well.
Yeah, that's great. A beautiful lesson I'm taking from that is to not think of those seasons where I've felt like I've been challenged or not my best mum. Don't think of that as a fixed state. Like it's a forever flowing and moving thing. It's not you were bad then and you're good now. It's just a whole sphere of emotions and experiences. Renee, I've loved learning from you. What an interesting knowledge base you have. If you could go back and tell that new mum, Renee, one thing about motherhood, career, or life, what would you go back and tell her?
God, about mother care. Well, that's a big one. I would probably tell her that it feels really hard right now, but these are all lessons that are going to shape you into the human being that you are going to become. And they are going to imprint on the legacy that you're going to leave, not only for your daughter, but for this entire world.
What a beautiful sentiment to end with. If people want to find you or your work online, where should they go?
Jump over to our website, which is ifillyourcup.com. Or we typically hang out in Instagram. So just fillyourcup_. And yeah, if they've got any questions or they want to learn more about what we do, then yeah, pop on over there.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Ready or Not. If you liked the show, please tell your friends, subscribe, or write a review. You can also find us on Instagram at readyornot.pod. That's it for today. We'll see you next time.